to go on to the very last case of this day. This endless day. And that is Appeal 12-2153, the United States of America versus Hargis. And Mr. Siu, whenever you're ready.
I was just pondering that I'm Brian Caillou, but pondering I'd round the morning out. You've had the whole breadth of the U.S. Code on the civil side and round it out with the morning on the U.S. Code on the criminal side. That's a pretty good morning. May it please the court, my name is Brian Caillou, and I'm an attorney for Lori Jo Hargis here today, who below was pleaded guilty to and was sentenced to conspiracy to use fire to commit wire fraud, which carries a maximum of 20 years imprisonment and or a $250,000 fine. And her conspiracy was to simply hire someone in a bad market or attempt to hire someone to burn her house down. Where the issue that Ms. Hargis has today that she presents to you, and which this court has expedited so kindly to get heard quickly, are the two adjustments for perjury and the leadership role given by the district court below, and then after those two adjustments that took her from what would have been a level 12 reduction for admission of guilt, brought her up to a 14, simply set aside or went beyond the statutory provisions or the set out in 3553 to warn a sentence outside, far outside, three or five times, depending on how you look at it, what the statutory advisory sentence would have called for. So those are the two aspects she has, which is purely her sentence, which would had at a range of 12 to 16 months, and Ms. Hargis was given 60 months.
Now, can't the district court consider the fact that she actually committed the underlying crime rather than only the conspiracy to commit the underlying crime as relevant conduct?
Yes, Judge. That's a fair, and I think the district court probably did factor that in greatly in its decision making. And I think looking around, the district court probably more likely than not looked at the Hatcher case, which has the exact same provision, conspiracy to commit fraud by means of fire. And in that case, the difference, though, fundamentally between those two cases, and there's a great deal of discussion by the district court judge about the Hatcher case, is that Judge Barker in the Hatcher case simply walked through very specifically how she reached her 10-year imprisonment sentence versus what Ms. Hargis received, which was 60 months, by very methodologically walking through the sentencing guideline or the 3553 factors and setting it out step by step. When you read and look at her compared to the actual gentleman who set the house on fire, Mr. White, he only received a sentence that was half as long as hers.
Of course, he was cooperating, right?
He was cooperating.
And they would have been pretty hard to make a case on her without him.
Yes.
The guideline, the applicable guideline here, does it take into account whether there was actually a fire, the destruction of the property?
Our reading of the guidelines themselves inherently include, there's many different ways, the underlying crime and the actual conspiracy are based on using explosive means, but inherently embodied in that would be some sort of destructive device, be it fire or be it explosion.
Right, but it does it account for whether the device is actually utilized, that is, that the explosives are detonated or what have you?
I think the underlying crime would. I don't think the conspiracy would.
There just seems to be kind of a disconnect here between the guideline that is applied to this type of offense.
And I would agree, but the conspiracy to have a fire versus a conspiracy for to using bomb making material are actually relatively similar. They both could have a minimum amount of destruction and death associated with it, or none at all, or they could have a maximum amount. And I think that's where Judge Young struggled with how to sentence Ms. Hargis, which was, it's not exactly the right crime, and I think this is one of the circumstances, like many you've heard before, where there just doesn't seem to be an actual right set of charges to correspond with the crime. I thought I was getting a question, Judge. I apologize.
No. I apologize. But I do want to ask you a question.
Okay.
How big a factor was the collateral and fraudulent litigation against State Auto in her sentence? I mean, suing State Auto for more than $8 million caused additional harm to State Auto. It taxed the resources of the court system. It should have accounted for some enhancement in her sentence, I think. Do you agree that it should have? And if you do agree, how much would have been reasonable? And if you don't agree, why don't you agree?
I think the companion litigation is probably something already included in the advisory commission, by the breadth of what they look at and the scope of what they factored into the range, the sentencing range itself, in the 12 to 16 months that she was involved. But yeah, anytime there's something inherently illegal, there's going to be a civil aspect to it, probably. And it's a matter of where's the threshold and how do you draw that line. Certainly, the district court's opinion doesn't leave us with a very clear guidance to how it reached the sentence it did. It simply said it doesn't appear to apply at all, and therefore your sentence, mentioning some of the collateral matters that you mentioned, Judge, is 60 months, which is, again, double or triple, depending on how you apply the advisory guidelines to it.
Well, I know you argue she wasn't a leader or organizer, but...
How can there be much doubt about that?
Yeah.
I think it's pretty arguable whether or not she obstructed justice, but I don't see that much argument about the leadership thing.
Well, I don't think she had any more role. I mean, if you really break down what she did in little modules, she had a childhood friend at her place of employment. There was a discussion about a home fire, but the fact her house wasn't selling, it on the market all this time, and arguably a second conversation or third conversation about the home won't be occupied. But as far as the leadership role, she actually wound up, if you look at the financial component of it, she didn't wind up any better off, probably worse off than
no, Deshaun. In the end, but had, right. had it worked, she would have gotten the biggest piece of the pie there.
Yeah, had it worked.
800 and some thousand.
I mean, she wasn't there, though. She wasn't. All she was not simply not home on the night of the fire in question. Other than that, and
no, but the neighbor certainly was.
No, the neighbor certainly was. But I mean, she wasn't there. She had nothing involved at all except making the connection with Mr. White and ultimately getting the benefit of the home burning down. If that in fact happened,
I would say that's 90% of it, though.
But that's inherently considered, I think, already in the advisory guidelines. And she did, I mean, the scope of what the advisory commission looks at, it's a conspiracy, but if your underlying crime is going to be arson, then that's the crime that the government should be held to charge and prosecute under.
But you didn't want that here, because then it would have been a 10-year mandatory minimum, wouldn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Right, and I think Judge Young appears to have split the difference between the 10-year mandatory minimum and the somewhere between the 10-year mandatory and 20-year sentence, and I think in his view he was doing the right thing, but certainly I don't think there's anything articulated clearly enough to comply with the factors outside of 3553 for the court to have jumped that much.
Do you think Mr. Ondarak is sitting over there thinking no good deed goes unpunished right now?
No, I don't think that at all, Judge.
But you are dealing with a 10-year mandatory minimum.
No, and I realize that. I'm just on the law, though. beyond a reasonable doubt and the government being held to their standard, whether there was a crime or not, it's what the system is about, and the statutory scheme is put forth and held to strict construction, and the old adage that no good deed goes unpunished is also rebutted by the fact our system hinges upon it's better that someone that's guilty remain free than someone that's innocent be in prison. And so for those reasons, we would believe that the advisory commissions should be followed, and the two-step adjustments, both for perjury and the leadership role, but perjury in particular, should be reversed and remanded, because I don't think the facts support that. This is a big, scary room, and there wasn't enough time, I don't think, if you look at the record from the time the district judge said, we're taking this off, you're not ready to plead today, to the time that she ultimately was basically admonished not to go forward, and the judge is indicating a withdrawal defense. That's defense is different inherently than
pleading
guilty.
Well, that was a mistake. He shouldn't have. That he was off base talking about withdrawal, I think. But I don't know how relevant that is to the. It could affect the sentence, but
right.
I don't see how it could have been withdrawal. She was pleading guilty.
She was pleading guilty. She was trying to anyway. I mean, that'd be a complete defense. It wouldn't reduce her sentence.
Well, White got three years, and she had two enhancements, and that comes out at five, I guess. And maybe that was his logic.
I don't know, but I think that's one of Ms. Hargis's fundamental issues here is clearly under the 3553 deviations, there ought to be a rationale set forth, and that's, I think, the Hatcher case is pretty clear in setting forth its rationale. I see my time is up.
Thank you. Mr. Andrek. Hello.
Hello. May it please the Court, Matthias Andrek appearing on behalf of the United States. I'm an assistant United States attorney from the Southern District of Indiana. Your Honors, in this case, the district court did what the district court is supposed to do at a sentencing. The court correctly calculated the advisory sentencing guidelines. The court then consulted those guidelines, then applied the facts of the case to the 3553 factors, and then came up with a sentence of 60 months, which is in line with what the co-conspirator got, as well as in line with the 3553 factors. The first enhancement at issue is this making a materially false statement. When the defendant came in to change her plea in December of 2011, she indicated, yes, she wants to plead guilty. But when pressed about what she did, her crime was, she blatantly lied to the court. Her initial statement to the court was that she talked to Vashawn White about it being a blessing if her house burned down, and then it was overheard by her secretary, and then she called Vashawn White and told him, do not burn my house down. Then, according to this lie, 3 months later, the house goes up in smoke. Of course, after hearing that, Judge Young pressed her on it and said, are you saying you specifically told Vashawn White, don't burn your house down? And she said, yes, that's what I told Vashawn White. That was a blatant lie, and the court did, I think, what a sentencing court or a district court should do and said, I'm not going to accept your guilty plea because you're not telling me you're guilty, and he set it for trial. We know what the truth is because of the facts we had with us, as well as her second change of plea, and that she had numerous conversations with Vashawn White after this August 2007 conversation. And the district court gave her the two-level enhancement for making a material false statement for two reasons. One is she, in effect, was saying she did withdraw from the conspiracy, and this wasn't just the district court coming up with this. As part of her proposed jury instructions for her jury trial, she was going to set out the withdrawal of defense. That was what her defense was.
She was pleading guilty, though. How would she withdraw from that?
Well, the first one, you're right, but I think the court has to find out if she's readily admitting guilt, and you're not, if you're saying you withdrew from the conspiracy. But the second reason...
Wait a minute. She pleaded guilty. You're saying she was withdrawing the first time and she didn't... Which of these discussions are you talking about?
The, the first time, it's not enough for a defendant just to say, I'd like to plead guilty because I think I am guilty or I feel like I'm guilty, which is what Hargis said. The court has to find a factual basis establishing her
She's
guilt.
She's trying to plead guilty, though. So how can she be trying to withdraw at the same time? I don't
Your Honor, I think she was trying to plead guilty by saying, I want to plead guilty and get it over with, but I withdrew from the conspiracy. But I want to point out there's a second reason, too, that it was a material lie.
The withdrawal instruction, was that submitted after the guilty plea hearing?
Yes, it was submitted after the guilty plea. Although, in conversations with defense attorneys, this was brought up before the guilty plea hearing. But, yes, it was submitted after. Okay. But there is a second reason, Your Honors, here for that two-level increase, and that is, and this is a case, U.S. v. White, a 2009 Seventh Circuit case I cited, that if a person attempts to minimize their role, that too is a material lie if they're lying. And here, clearly, she was attempting to minimize her role. If the court accepted her guilty plea and said, even though you're saying you called him and told him not to, I accept the guilty plea, and proceeded to sentencing, at that point, the district court was going to sentence the defendant based on, she said it was a blessing if her house burned down, and this guy took it upon himself 2 or 3 months after that conversation to light up her house. That's not even remotely close to the level of culpability that is the truth in this case and the level of culpability that the defendant did in regards to this conspiracy.
Do you agree with Judge Young that this is not a run-of-the-mill arson case? And if you do, why?
Absolutely. Several reasons. First of all, she engaged in a conspiracy to burn her children's house down and all their possessions.
So,
yes, it's
it's
deplorable, I think, anytime you burn an apartment down or somebody else's. As a parent, it's completely unconscionable. The same month as Christmas, the same month as a 7-year-old's birthday to have the house torched. And he pointed that out as one of the reasons. But that's unique to the case. The incredible amount of claims she had, including the $8-plus million bad faith claim, I think that's unique to the case. Not every arson-for-profit conspiracy involves that. So the bad faith claim, the fact that she overrepresented her losses, and we get that from the amount of her losses, coupled with the two torches, the people who burned the house down. When they went inside, they found clothing missing, and low-end jewelry when she claims thousands of dollars. That's unique. The level of deceit that she had went all the way up through her first change of plea hearing, where she lied under oath to the insurance company, she lied under oath to the judge in order to get this money. All those factors, I think, are unique to this conspiracy, in addition to the fact that, as this court pointed out earlier, a neighbor was almost seriously hurt because thinking the 7-year-old was inside went to help. But the district judge considered all those factors. And I don't agree with what was argued in defense counsel's brief that the district court didn't seriously take into account the guidelines. The court took into account the guidelines, saw that it was something that didn't make sense in applying them to the arson for profit conspiracy in that the headline was about explosive materials. The enhancement was about the weight of explosive materials or whether or not these explosive materials were stolen. It just didn't seem to apply. But the court didn't stop there. It also looked to case law and saw
Does the guideline consider whether the explosives are detonated or actually put into use?
Your Honor, I'm not certain on that. But it was all about the explosives, and I think the title of that guideline gives it away. But I do want to point out one thing in regards to that. Keep in mind that 18 U.S. Code 844H makes it a crime to use fire to commit another federal offense. In this case, we charge fire to commit the arson. But conceivably, there are other federal offenses, and that's why I think this guideline, it's difficult for it to be a catch-all for every specific fact because there could be other possibilities in that. But again, the district court looked for case law, came up with Hatcher. The district court looked for the Congress's intent and discovered that doing the underlining offense carries with it a 120-month mandatory minimum sentence. And then it made a point, and it even on the record, the district court made a point of saying the 3553 factors, although always important, are even more important in this case because these guidelines just don't make sense. And then the court went over the factors that I just went over with the court about the bad faith claim, about the danger to the neighbor, about burning one's own child's house down, about the deceit. And it should be noted the court also sentenced the co-conspirator Vashawn White to 3 years. That was an above-guideline sentence even after a 5K substantial assistance motion. So the district court considered this a particularly egregious offense and applied it to both co-conspirators. If the court doesn't have any questions, then I'll yield the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And I think you used up all your time, but I'm going to give you an extra 2 minutes at the risk of... Hard hearts up here.
I will try to be brief.
Well, judges, you're going to have to be or I'll be set upon.
Very brief. First off, there's a fundamental difference between what the government charges and what someone's convicted with. And there are many ways for wire fraud for that to have occurred. I would agree with that. But again, that belies the point that you should be charged and convicted of a crime and sentenced in accordance with the crime. The fact that there's a defect or otherwise in the charging information is what keeps the law from becoming diluted. If the government can't meet their burden on the charges that they have charged, then the sentence shouldn't be reflective of a charge that wasn't brought. The second point, we keep getting back to Hatcher, and I think it's the fundamental case. I think it's important to look at the factual distinctions, which Hatcher was eight years of fires, I think 39 occupancies or dwellings, and two people injured. So that case, it is, if you're using it as a comparison and a benchmark, is way out of whack with what Ms. Hargis had working backward, if you're using that as the benchmark. So with that, those factual and legal distinctions, I'll leave it alone. And I thank you for having me up here.
Thank you. Thanks to both parties for a really well-argued case. And the case, of course, will be taken under advisement. And this court will stand in recess until Monday morning at 9:30. And have nice trips home. Bye-bye.